long stories about fodder. Stories which bend inside, outside, and come down on the far side of true and the near side of admirable. Thin shores of disorderly conflict and old expected parables of boastful ignorance and fatal flaws. But this is a short story, which calls for a bit of a deliberate exposition, as there's less time to soak it in secondhand. So Fodder's about 6 feet and 1 inch high, but he seems much taller when he's on a roll. And when he's losing, he seems much shorter. And he's thin, so if he's being quiet, he sometimes fades into the walls, doors, columns, and such, as though he's no longer there. But that's if he's quiet, which he isn't often. The alternative is that he's talking, and he's either telling a story or he's getting caught up in one, more than likely. Fodder's non-discriminating, which is to say that he'd just as soon as tell your story as his own. When he reaches his hands outward towards sky, sun, stars, and various chemical bliss, his love is intended for all and everyone. And when he shakes his fists in various chemical rages, it is to wish toward clearing the earth of every sapiens alive. Fodder's a man of simple extremes. This short story starts off like so many accidents in the home. Fodder was pacing the floor, measuring the width of the room again, in case there was shrinkage, either in his feet or the room's dimensions. Simple precautions keep idle suspicions from becoming full-blown paranoia. But nonetheless, it takes up a fair amount of time. That was when the phone call about the furniture going to drinking came in. Drinking is the next town over, in a dry county with an ironic sense of humor. Because Fodder didn't like to drink on the job, he rarely worked. But he agreed to pack and drive a truckload of furniture to drinking, being that the asker was the young widow of John Berrythorne, a friend who'd passed away about 6 months prior. Now, widow brings to mind an image of a small gray lady dressed in black. But Minnie Berrythorne was no classical widow. If widowing were a long-standing and honored craft, steeped in tradition, then this widow would have been a genuine rebel, a groundbreaking innovator, a real individual who had no time for the traditions of the past and cut her own colorful swath across the conservative landscape of all the widows who'd ever widowed before her. But of course, there aren't even trade magazines for widowing. So her fresh approach was not documented, nor could it ever be influential. Through our accumulated knowledge, here in this room, of the cultural institutions of marriage, death, and film and television, we know a few things about colors and what they say about the person who wears them. White is the color of innocence. Black is death. Red is the mark of the scarlet woman. Green is for jealousy. Orange is a pretty color, which doesn't tell you a whole lot about the individual personality-wise. This widow, as Fodder pulls his step van up for the moving afternoon, is wearing a Pollock painting. It actually is, though not on the original canvas. Some rejected Pollock painting, perhaps never completed, it's difficult to say. Sold in a third try, large lot auction, printed on fabric, sewn into a dress as unsophisticatedly appealing as top 40 music, sleek and with cliched allusions to futurism and the return of not the 60s, but the return of subconscious nostalgia for the 60s. All these subtleties long ago invested into a pattern and lost to their accumulated effect. In terms of the previously mentioned groundbreaking widowness, she's neither disabled by her husband's death, nor is she satisfied by it, nor arranged its occurrence, for those of you with darker suspicions in the room. She never wished her husband ill, but upon the event of his death, she was inspired to realize the full spectrum of opportunity in front of her, and that she had in fact never actively pursued ambitions, perhaps never had an ambition, other than modest ones affiliated closely with her marriage. Her husband ran a small business, a hardware store, for many years in Ecstasy, the next town over from drinking. Ecstasy is a city of misplaced ambitions and no sense of irony whatsoever. The local hardware store did a busy trade with customers from not only drinking in ecstasy, but also Joyride, Penitentiary, Whooping Cough, Juxtapose, Spinal Column, and the small but financially well-endowed Hamlet of Regret. Regret was a little further down the road and up a mountain, but wealthy regressions, nonetheless, regularly sent their irony-laden servants to Ecstasy to fetch special-ordered parts for saunas and hot tubs which were being installed in the air-conditioned homes of Regret. The upshot of this is that the widow's dear-departed husband made a fat wad from his small hardware concern. The profits of his business were intended to fund the retirement which he did not live long enough to revel in. He squirreled his cash away in bank accounts, savings bonds, mutual funds, planning to retire at age 48, providing he'd reached a specific dollar amount goal by then. However, he forgot what that figure was in the rush of the marketplace and the accounting book, and by the time he diversified his savings so much, he would have had no simple way of tallying the value of his holdings anyway. By the time he died at age 36 of piano dropped on the head disease, he had tripled his target figure with his savings alone, which does not even figure in the value of the business itself. His widow sold the business to a former servant of Regret for a pretty penny and an interest in the business moving forward, which the new owner planned to expand further into the leisure hardware market since he knew the target audience intimately and had a substantial grudge against them. So she, the widow in question, is rich and has newly realized that she has the ability to do anything or anyone that she wants. Anyway, that's how Fodder tells it, sort of. Even if you believe him, as he grasps the bar rail like a kid who never doggy paddles far from the side of the pool, even if his split-syllable insistences don't make you dismiss the testimony as entirely fictional, you must sort between listening and reading into pauses and defensive exclamations to get what really happened. The liaison on the couch in the back of the truck just pulled up and drinking is representative of something in reality more like an impropriety that Fodder offered at the time, a compliment or a dirty joke. Her gentle parry of a response was the catalyst for a lurid mental reaction in Fodder's head, no doubt extrapolated to some conclusion of pre-carnal nudity or nuptial obligation, which, while perhaps not without a perverse and curious interest, seemed rife with complication to him. Far worse, it would seem to also call for conscious decision-making of a sort that Fodder had grown genuinely allergic to in his long-lost years. But nonetheless, the process, the frantic chemical electrical billy trail of image and of fragments of dialogue appropriated from countless R, X, and TV movie bedroom scenes, slightly altered to fit in a flash the situation in front of him at the time, were a vivid coalescence which rendered it as though a genuine event, a story in his memory to relate whenever the next opportunity to get attention presented itself. There in Fodder's mind, as legitimate as any actual event, getting stopped by Officer Coldwater or the Spinal Column Police Force, or the mundane details of overdue rent and his understocked refrigerator. And Fodder tells it well, though we don't end up believing him, and he tells in great detail from arousal to broken heart, in such vivid language that I can recall every word of the description and could relate it to all of you this evening, syllable for syllable. But then I promised this would be a short story, and so it is.